Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Martin Luther King Jr., whose annual natal holiday was this past Monday, condemned laissez-faire oppression. He or she who passively accepts evil is as much involved in it as he or she who hopes to perpetuate it, MLK said. He and she who accepts evil without protesting against it is merely cooperating with it. Jack London, whose fame as a writer rests primarily on his stories of Yukon and ocean adventure at the turn of the 20th century, might also be claimed that his real call of the wild was his voracious penchant for socialism, and he really did attempt to light a fire in the minds of Americans against the iron heel of capitalist oppression. He wrote his most controversial book, The Iron Heel, in 1908, and it is considered to be the earliest form of what is called dystopian fiction. And it takes place in the USA in the two decades between 1912 through 1932, during which a so-called oligarchy of capitalist business and wealth rises to supremacy, which London calls the Iron Heel, the book's title, of oppression, and maintains power through a slave labor caste and counterforce mercenaries. The Iron Heel mercilessly stomps upon the socialist and proletariat revolutionaries. This is our answer, the plutocrats snarl to the proletariats. We will grind you revolutionists down under our heel, and we shall walk upon your faces. George Orwell said nearly the same thing in his book, 1984. If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping a human face forever, he wrote. London wrote, we must accept the capitalist stage in social evolution as about on a par with the earlier monkey stage. And it was inevitable, he wrote, that much of the mire and slime of this early stage, quote, should cling and not be easily shaken off, unquote. There is a greater strength than wealth, London wrote in The Iron Heel. One strength, the strength of the proletariat, is in our muscles, in our hands to cast ballots, in our fingers to pull triggers. The Iron Heel influenced Orwell's most famous book, 1984, according to a biographer, and Orwell, aka Eric Blair, himself said that London made a very remarkable prophecy of the rise of fascism, and that London's understanding of the primitive made him a better prophet than many better informed and more logical thinkers. And that was Orwell. Primitive communism, chattel slavery, serf slavery, and wage slavery were necessary stepping stones in the evolution of society, Jack London wrote in The Iron Heel. Without them, anarchy would reign and humanity would drop backward into the primitive night out of which it had so painfully emerged. It should serve as a warning to those rash political theorists of today who speak with certitude of social processes, London wrote. And now, welcome once more to the dystopian realm of Evangelica 5440, which is quite the sinister opposite of Ecotopia, a pitiless theolytical tyranny where every lie is made eternal truth and every life disappears from record as though it never existed. Today's program concludes my takeoff of both George Orwell, aka Eric Blair, and Robert Heinlein. Like the old movie serials of yore, a brief rehash of what has happened. Winston Smith, professional history shift changer for Evangelica's brutal reign of sodomic priests, has committed a final act of treachery against the regime. He has fallen into sedition and romance, which are, of course, deserved of death and discorporation. God is dead is Winston's mortal mantra. One evening, Winston Smith took a book given him by a priest he thought to be an ally to the attic room above an antique store a couple of hours before Julia was to arrive. He read about the political subversion that underlay perpetual spiritual war, the manipulation of religious fervor to attain material goals, actually a single goal, power, pure and supreme, absolute, the power of God, not a benevolent God. History proved the weakness of benevolence. Raw power, violent and cruel was the creed. The power of the Big Bang, the instant God created the universe with a mighty clap of hands. That was the power the Holy Order intended to wield over the world, the most elemental power possible. Sanctioned by the mandate of celestial supremacy, the priests set about spiritually sanitizing their increasing flocks, virtually perpetual wirebrush cleansing of the faithful while always watchful for contagiously faithless heretics. The order was in conflict with any person, creed, or idea that did not recognize its supremacy, and opponents were not forgiven or reformed. They were mercilessly hunted down and exterminated without any record remaining of their brief existence. The establishment of a militant theocracy had been absurdly easy. The Christian evangelical movement rose rapidly from spurned obscurity to political dominance, using a combination of dynamic evangelism, television, money, and high-tech methods of advertising and propaganda, as well as sanctified corruption, to win local and national elections and mandate laws that discriminated against homosexuals, assertive women, non-Christians, and other pariahs. The long-held fear that communism or socialism would ultimately triumph was irrevocably reversed when the major communist empires and socialist states collapsed. More startling was the rapid rise in the vacuum of conservative religious orders all over the world that only quickly dominated their parent religions, but wrestled political control of nearly half the planet with blinding swiftness. American evangelists had endured a half century quietly organizing, clinging to harsh doctrines that tolerated no deviation from ancient scripture, and waiting for the internal collapse of Great Sodom, the United States, which they were certain would occur at the millennium. Liberal democracy was especially demonic to the protectors of old-time religion. Women debased in the marketplace, not as chattel, but as aspiring corporate CEOs, flaunting unspeakable feminism at the devout faithful. Deviant homosexuals boldly challenging traditional values. Heretical sects such as Buddhists, Muslims, and abominable Catholics practicing their heresies openly. And the Jewish problem awaited solution. Great Sodom was perfidiously sabotaged from within by the evangelical agenda, which practiced political subversion and theft of elections. Freedom of religion disappeared when the evangelists triumphed at the polls. The first act of the Sacred Ecumenical Council, as Congress was renamed, was to abolish all other religions in favor of a state religion established by the Holy Order, which had usurped the presidency. The next act was to purge heretics. Massive roundups and executions in the early years set a pattern still followed of sanctioned inquisition. Arrests and executions were a daily routine. Public trials and executions entertained and terrified the faithful. The fear of God inspired love of God as terror inspired faith. Winston's own memory was confused. He thought he once knew about the spread of evangelical fervor that reformed the Western Hemisphere. TV preachers infected an ever-increasing public with negative platitudes that encouraged isolation and persecution of heretics, homosexuals, free-thinking women, people of color, Jews as a matter of ancient vengeance for the death of Christ, and anyone anywhere accused of impure thought. The two primary aims of the ecclesiastical party, which evolved into the Holy Order once political control was attained, was to establish supreme power in all parts of the world and to eradicate completely and totally independent thinking. The order grasped territory like a surge of locusts. Disbelief accounted for much of the early successes of the faithful, a laconic inability by many to believe the zealots were serious, even as evangelical power thrust in all directions, until blunted by adversaries equally militant and eager for worldly power. The disbelievers quickly became believers or vanished. The book's author wrote that ethnic wars in the Balkans after the communist collapse spread throughout Eastern Europe until a renewed Islamic surge similar to its original conquest overwhelmed the exhausted survivors and reoccupied as much territory as the old Ottoman Empire at its height. These were the great Satans, Winston thought, and the incessant war between them and Holy Evangelica was fought over the partially nuked ruins of what had recently been Western Europe. Christianized Yahweh and Muslim Allah would be no more than rival gangsters if they were judged by the rabid violence of their followers. The pagans were generally Oriental Asians, but accommodated a large mixture of the planet's races, as well as exiles from the two theocracies. Nor did they especially suppress polyglot religions. Instead of a single state, the pagans were a loose confederation of usually cooperative warlords. The Holy Evangelical Empire's perpetual crusade against them was fought primarily in equatorial lands, ostensibly for conversion of souls, but also for a few raw materials and slave labor. Power seesawed so rapidly that the native populations were never quite sure who their latest masters were. The use of nuclear power upon the great Satans and pagans was a nearly irresistible yearning of the more frenzied evangelicals. Certain retaliatory destruction provided a reluctant damper similar to the balance of terror that characterized the old Cold War. Visions of thermonuclear surprise upon their enemies obsessed influential clerics of the order. Equally obsessive were the fears that the Satans or pagans might at any moment make the same attempt. As a result, a non-litigated agreement to not use nuclear weapons in their interminable wars existed between the foes, though each constantly sought a method or opportunity to obliterate the other two. Winston closed the book and stared at the floor. He understood that his flashes of intuition about the past were really fragments from his not completely laundered subconscious. As he read, he felt deja vu. He had once known most of what was in the book. Doublethink had sealed off his knowledge, although brief fragments leaked through occasionally, which usually startled him. At that moment, he wished his diary was near. He felt an intense compulsion to restore the truth, to correct every revision he had personally contributed to the big lie. Julia arrived and they quickly made love on the old four-poster bed, a furnishing of the attic apartment which had initially attracted them. Afterward, Winston attempted to synthesize what he had read earlier. Julia nodded as he spoke. "That's simply a surface explanation," she said. "The real question is not why religious zealots contradict power for faith, but why the subject majority allows bigots and sadists to victimize them with superstitious hatred." "What about the soul?" he asked. "How is the soul so easily jeopardized?" Winston, dear, that was not even the question when the order took over. Even many Jews, my parents among them, thought God had abandoned them during the Holocaust. Fate of the soul was not very important except to fanatical cults of evangelical Christians, she said. Their leaders terrified them with eternal damnation if they did not seize political control of Great Sodom, the former USA. But that was a strategy to galvanize support for a religious insurrection. Supreme power on earth was their real goal, Julia said. Humans died, but power was eternal. Dear Winston, she said quietly, why do you think sex is a criminal act that we risk death every moment we are with each other? Because it is disloyal, she answered before his mouth opened. Because love is disloyal. It threatens absolute power. We will abolish the orgasm, a shrill voice shouted from inside a wall. Jackbooted men in black uniforms rushed up the stairs while others crashed through the attic's windows from ropes on the roof. Winston and Julia had only the briefest moment to stare helplessly at each other before they were shoved apart and kicked to the floor. A thin, elderly man in a black overcoat stood over them. He wore insignia of the God Squad Officer Corps. Winston was shocked to recognize him as the kindly owner of the antique store downstairs who had rented him the room. God's eyes are everywhere, the man said pompously, raising arms and finger. He was the voice that had shouted from the wall, obviously from an audio-video device installed to spy on the illicit lovers. You cannot escape the eyes of God, he said. The elderly officer kicked Winston just below the ear. He saw the boot the instant it crashed into his head, and he lost consciousness. They were separated, of course. Winston did not see Julia again. He regained his senses in a cell. He was somewhere in the Ministry of Love. He had no idea the time, day or night, nor would he for many months. He lived among eternal lights. His cell beamed as bright as a television stage. He was left undisturbed at first, but under constant surveillance. He was hungry and not allowed to sleep. Smith, you will remain awake, a voice demanded from a telescreen loudspeaker whenever his eyes closed or his head drooped. Pray in the proper manner, which, though compulsory, at least permitted him to sit on a bench, and he was not forced to clasp his hands and point them upward. He felt almost too exhausted to maintain a reverent expression, but each time he slipped out of a prayerful attitude or catnapped, the loudspeaker peppered his numbed brain like buckshot. Others were temporarily crowded into his cell, and although he recognized one or two, the loudspeaker screeched whenever he attempted conversation. A man he thought a perfect moronic booster of the order sat next to him briefly and moaned over and over, I am a sinner. I deserve to be punished. What did you do? Winston whispered. I sinned in thought, the man screeched. Thank God my daughter overheard me talking in my sleep, he said rather proudly. She informed the God Squad before I became a sinner indeed. Then one day, or it might have been night, Winston thought, the high priest he had trusted with his innermost objections entered his cell. The priest smiled grimly. You act surprised, he said as Winston stiffened. But you knew all along, Winston. You knew the instant of your first deviant thought that this was your fate and that I was your confessor. Winston shook his head, confused, his mind flooding with self-ordained persecution. You knew I was your inquisitor, his betrayer accused. Winston realized that although Catholicism, officially portrayed as the parent religion, not Judaism, had been swept into the dustbin of theology, certain purgatories had been grafted onto the neo-Protestant succession. the necessity of confession by the accused, public demanded for high-profile heretics, Jews, and captured Satan pagans, was a hybrid from the truncated papists, who at least kept private the sins of the confessed and granted redemption. For prisoners of Winston status, minor functionaries guilty of small heresies, the trials were perfunctory, a televised laundry list of sins whose only interest was the inevitable execution, its form selected by an interactive poll of viewers whose choices range from ancient stoning to holographic dissipation of human cellular structure, sort of a swirling crimson fog as the condemned disincorporated. The woman has already betrayed you, the Inquisitor told Winston. Now you will betray her. The torture he always feared began. His Inquisitor said he was not ready for the release of death. His impure mind was to be thoroughly cleansed before it was blown apart. The Inquisitions of the past failed because the condemned died as martyrs, which inflamed heresy. The state trials and public confessions staged by the early 20th century totalitarians were known to be false and lost their force. The Holy Order did not make that mistake, the priestly inquisitor told Winston. All confessions made here are true. We make them true. We will burn all evil and delusion out of you. We will reshape your mind. You will love God in your heart and soul. Then we will eliminate you. Winston and everything that ever related to his existence would be expunged from memory and record. He would be, the Inquisitor said, lifted clear out of the stream of history. What about my soul? Winston's voice cracked. The soul belongs to God, the Inquisitor answered, anticipating the question which all heretics asked. If God wishes to dispose of a soul, then it is necessary for us to erase any trace of it. There is no such hell as Dante and the other medievals conjured, the Inquisitor said. The rejected soul disappears from all memory of having existed. A non-soul in the manner its corporeal persona is made a non-person, the true hell. Once again, Winston was left alone for a while. He was properly fed and allowed to sleep. He expanded from near emaciation to an almost healthy appearance, although most of his hair had fallen out and his hands were misshapen from broken fingers. His nose remained mashed, but he was given a bridge to replace broken teeth. He worked very hard to transform his brain. He forcibly shut down his heresy, disguised from himself his unrelenting hatred for the order. He attended all religious services and functions within the huge ministry of love. He radiated purity in form and manner. He strained toward spiritual oneness with God, which required constant personal abnegation mixed with abject terror. Yet he hoarded his hatred in a small place, ready for the instant of his death to flood his being like a sudden inflated life preserver. But even this small refuge was ripped out of him. One night, Winston shouted Julia's name while dreaming. Instantly awake, he was clearly aware of his final undoing. Winston was taken from his cell to a large room where his inquisitor waited. Across the room was a large cage filled with birds, hundreds of birds. Winston loathed birds. Birds made his skin crawl. He could almost bear to see a bird through a window, but outside near them, he felt deathly sick. He nearly lost consciousness as he stared at hundreds of sharp, scissor-like beaks. His head throbbed with their shrill shrieks and whistles. The Inquisitor moved to quickly open the cage door. Winston felt the guards begin to push him inside. "Do it to Julia," he screamed. "Do it to Julia, not to me." Free at last, the Inquisitor smirked. Nothing was left in Winston to resist. A light of primitive mystery beamed in his brain, dissolving any remaining molecules of doubt and disbelief hiding in his synapses. He was a true believer, unabashed and unashamed in his passionately tearful proclamations of his return to the faith. Born again, he shouted to all who would hear in the immense labyrinth of the ministry of love. He waited eagerly for his upcoming trial, ready to reveal and confess everything to the divine Inquisition Tribunal and the great mass of the faithful transfixed at their television screens. He exulted in framing what he would say to the ecclesiastic judges and primetime audience, carefully composing his final testament of faith. Winston had won victory over himself. He loved God. This is Michael McCusker. Dylan Hauser Schalk is engineer of this program. It has been 95 years since the 1927 silent movie Metropolis was filmed, directed by Fritz Lang and scripted by Fia von Harbou from her book of the same title. Metropolis is perhaps the most classic remnant of Germany's post-World War I Weimar Republic, which was only a few years later abolished by the Nazi regime of Adolf Hitler. Metropolis is a famous parable about tyranny and enslavement of the working class, which was even then being specifically defined as fascism, the name given to Benito Mussolini's burgeoning dictator of Italy since 1920. As impatient as we all might be at the restrictions of the current pandemic, do not for a moment forget we are engaged in a world war against disease in which millions of our species have already died and threatens the rest of us as surely as a colliding comet or a broiling sun. Protect yourself and everybody else. Vaccinate and isolate. Wear a mask when among other hominids.